What I'd like to look at today, having gone through a detailed biography of Rav Kook yesterday, I mean fairly detailed, long enough I think for what we need, I'd like to launch into some of the issues that we flagged yesterday that made him so much of an original thinker. And today I'd like to talk about the issue of science and Limud Echol and secular studies. Pass that back, please. Secular studies. Now, this is something that we're obviously, all of us in our world today, very connected with as an idea. I'm sure all of you grew up in an environment in which secular studies, college, secular learning, whether it's science or humanities or literature or whatever, history, is important on some level. It's not just irrelevant. It's relevant. And maybe not just relevant to the issue where I need to get a degree so that I can get a job. I mean, there are degrees like that. Maybe most people's focus when they go to college these days is, the only reason I'm here is because I need a degree, otherwise I can't get a job. Fair enough. But there is such a thing as education for the sake of being educated as well. Being an intelligent and a person who can understand the world around them. And therefore, at various times through Jewish history, we've had to grapple with this issue. Do we as Jews, who have our own very detailed thought system, which really tells us about pretty much everything that you need to know on a daily basis anyway, are we interested in getting involved in non-religious or non-Jewish thought systems at all? And we talked about this. We had a class on this a while ago. I don't remember what I taught you and when I taught it to you. But there is a fundamental machlokas in the Gemara between Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, on the one hand, which I haven't put on the sheet, as to whether it's legitimate to do anything else but learning Torah. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says you can only learn Torah. Certainly for a man, you must only learn Torah, not get distracted by anything else. And Rabbi Yishmael says, no, you bring from the Pozik in the Chumash, in the Shema, Va'asafta Diganecha. Did we have this conversation? I think we did. I can remember. Va'asafta Diganecha means you may gather your crops. The Gemara asks, why would you tell me to gather my crops? I know. If I planted them, then I'm not going to just forget about them. The answer is, no, this is a heter. You can get involved in work, gathering crops. You can make a living. You're allowed to do that. And Shimon Bar Yochai said, if you start gathering in crops, you'll be plowing and reaping and sowing, and you'll never get out of that, and you'll never learn anything. Excuse me. And the Gemara there concluded, many people tried, like Rabbi Yishmael, to combine work and learning, and it worked out well for them. But when many people tried, like Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, then it didn't work out well for them, from which the poskim understand from that on a practical level, for the many, for the multitude, for the masses, they have to work, they have to earn a living, and they have to learn when they can, and they have to make that combination. For the few, they should be involved in full-time learning. Okay, that's a very small synopsis. Then there was another machlokas again, between, or not even the machlokas, but Rabbi Yishmael's nephew asked him the following. He asked him, listen, I know that you're the kind of guy who's balanced, you know, you working and learning, that's your position, but I want to ask you a different question. He says, I've learned the whole of the Torah, which is a bit of a very stretch for even for someone as great as his nephew, who I'm sure was a very great person. Really, you've learned, but anyway, he said, I've learned the whole of the Torah. I now want to learn Greek wisdom. This is not for the purposes of gathering his crops or making a living or just surviving. It's for the purposes of interest. I want to learn philosophy. I want to learn Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, etc. And his uncle, what did his uncle say to him, do you remember?
Yuchazara, you didn't learn anything.
Okay, he didn't say that. Just one second, please. He didn't say do chazara. What did he say? He said, it says in Yeshua, you have to learn Torah day and night. If you can find a time that is neither day nor night, then you can learn Torah then. From which the conclusion is that...
You can learn other than Torah.
You can learn other Torah. Yes, excuse me, thank you. You can learn other wisdoms then. But your days and your nights have to be learning Torah, but they're... So is there a time which is neither here nor there? Yes, there is. There's the Bein HaShemashot. There's the kind of twilight zone every day. And there were some poskim, the Yaivas Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who took this very literally. He would only learn secular subjects between, like, sunset and the stars coming out. That's when he could probably get a lot done then. But most people understood, and the Ramah in Shulchan Aruch says, no, what this means is your Torah learning should be your main thing, and everything else should be like he's back cry. It's on a sort of casual basis, not your fixed thing. Sita, yes, question.
Man is supposed to study all day and all night. How do they live?
Well, that was the question. For most people, they can't study all day and all night.
Do people still do that today?
Yes, there are people who still study the whole time, and the answer is other people support them, which is what we believe in as a society, right? We take perfectly work-capable 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23-year-olds, and we tell them to go to college for years and study, and we'll kind of subsidize that to some level. I mean, in America you're not, because you have meant to take loans for millions of dollars and pay it back later. But in more compassionate societies, they have people, they have hacks, you know, and they pay money for college, whatever to support. I didn't pay a penny to go to university. That was expected from your tax, but you pay tax to get education. Okay, fine. That's not quite the same even in England now, but whatever. So the point is that, yes, we believe in supporting certain people, a small group, in full-time learning, whether it's college or Lahavdil, Kollel or whatever it is. Fine. Now, I put this on the board. This is an introduction to what we're going to do today with Rav Kook. There have been three main times in Jewish history where this has been a real crunch question for us. The first time is when all of this stuff started, when the Greeks began to develop secular knowledge, science in its infancy, in this is BCE, obviously, in around the 4th, 5th century BCE, through that period, the Second Temple, through the period after the Churban, there was a real debate going on. This is exactly when these rabbis are discussing it. There's a real debate going on. Do we want to get involved in secular learning or not get involved in secular learning? The Greeks, the Hellenists, the Hashmonaim, the Hanukkah story, this is all part of that whole discussion. So that was a really hot issue. Then it really went away largely because the period of the Gemara, which is really this period, the Jews were in Babel. It was not a place of deep secular learning in the same way. They weren't exposed. The rabbis in the Gemara themselves are not so conflicted with this. They were basically learning Torah. This is oversimplified, but basically. Then in the Golden Age of Spain, when the Jews found themselves as Sephardi Jews in Spain and North Africa, so the Arabs started translating a lot of the Greek literature, the Greek philosophy, into Arabic, and then came back into the Jewish community through the Arabic, because the Jews here were not speaking Greek. Here the Jews all spoke Greek. Everybody spoke Greek. That was the language. Okay, here the Jews spoke Arabic. So when the Arabs translated all of these works of learning, so they began to read them again. So then there was a big debate. The Rambam, the Ramban, the Spanish Jewish philosophers, should we be learning secular, not philosophy? Will it take you off the derech? Will it make you less from? Will it make you more knowledgeable intellect? Lots of discussions. And then things very much went into a kind of downswing because the Jewish people were really not exposed to that anymore in Spain. They were scattered around. In Ashkenaz, the Enlightenment started late. Yeah, the Renaissance in Europe started around this time, but it took until the 18th to 19th century for the Jews to kind of get on top of that, because they were only allowed out of the ghettos at the end of the 1700s. Okay? So once you hit the 18, 1900s, 20th century, 21st century, once again, we have this question, should we or shouldn't we? Now we have access to it again, and we've got good brains, should we get involved in this or not? And Rav Kook is coming right at the beginning of the 20th century, when this is a very, very big debate. Two things before we get into Rav Kook. First of all, Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, in the 19th century, he's around, let's call him 1830 to 80, something around that, when he's mostly active. Rav Hirsch, you want a sheet, Gina? Rav Hirsch developed a philosophy, a hashkafa, let's call it hashkafa, of, what was his hashkafa called? It was called Torah in Derech Eretz. What does that mean, Torah in Derech Eretz? Again, that's not our focus for today, but you need to know about this. Torah in Derech Eretz means he believed in a system of Torah, where Torah was the principal, primary thing that people would learn, but with Derech Eretz, Rav Hirsch understands, and I've got to share online, and we maybe had a class, I don't remember, but you can read up about that. Derech Eretz means secular culture, secular learning. You know, he says first you have to be a Derech Eretz Jew, which means that you have to be a human being, which means that you have to be intelligent and educated and then you can build on top of that Torah. Because if you're not a human, then you can't be a Jew. A Jew is a human and then develops further into a Jew. And to be a human, you have to have the culture and the understanding of the world around you. So Torah in Derech Eretz was a very successful Western European system. Okay, in Germany.
New.
What's that?
Brand new. Everybody else? Torah.
Right. In Eastern Europe, it was very Torah. Because again, like I said yesterday, in Eastern Europe, there wasn't as much academia. The non-Jewish world were not as developed, as cultured. Now, of course, you might turn around with the benefit of hindsight and say, how cultured were the Western Europeans? After the 19th century, where everything looked so promising, we hit the 20th century, where everything went haywire. Okay? That's a good question, which I'm not getting into now, but that was Torah in Derech Eretz. Torah in Derech Eretz was very successful in Germany, but it didn't really survive into the 20th century. Why not? What did it become? So there's all sorts of reasons historically and geopolitically why that happened. The First World War, the Second World War, not getting into that now. But Torah in Derech Eretz kind of morphed into two other combinos, if you like. One is Torah Umada. Torah Umada. What's Torah Umada?
YU.
Who said YU? YU. YU, Stern, etc. Where the crest of Yeshiva University is Torah Umada. Torah Umada is a development of Torah and Derech Eretz. It's more about Torah and learning and academia. It really is almost an outgrowth of something which kind of was an adjunct of Torah and Derech Eretz, which was called Wissenschaft. Wissenschaft, in case you ever come across it, there's Judentum, okay? Which basically means the scholarly analysis of Judaism, which kind of grew into Jewish studies later on in the 20th century. But this idea of applying scholarly thought to Judaism in a way which is religiously authentic, which of course is a big question, kind of all developed into Torah or Mada, where you can study Judaism, either academic studies of Judaism or just traditional, you go to yeshiva, you learn Gemara half the day, you learn science half the day, you learn literature, you learn whatever. So Torah Umada is one reality, which of course came after Rav Kook. And the other one is developed into Torah V'Avodah. What's Torah V'Avodah? B'nei Akiva. B'nei. Okay? B'nei Akiva, Torah V'Avodah, is that let's take the development of humankind and focus it on Eretz Yisrael. Many of the B'nei Akiva founders were German Jews, Western European Jews, that came out of the Torah and Derech Eretz system, but once it became possible to come to Israel and develop the land, etc., they focused that development outside Torah in building Eretz Yisrael. Now, Rav Hirsch himself was not a Zionist. He was quite parable or even negative about Zionism, because he felt that you didn't need to run to another country to be a cultured person. But of course, already by the 20th century, Rav Hirsch's view had been quite sidelined. Don't forget that the Reform Movement, when its early days, was very anti-Zionist, because it saw the Zionism as a part of the problem. We're not trying to be different from everybody else and our own national unit. We're trying to be Jews within the broader society. But eventually, Reform became more pro-Zionist. Maybe it's now becoming more anti-Zionist again. Okay, there's a whole question as to how things move. Okay, fine. That's all by way of background. Rav Kook, of course, is not from any of these backgrounds. He's from Eastern Europe. All of these things were developments of Western Europe. But he's from Eastern Europe, where there's a lot of Haskalah. We talked about that yesterday, the sort of Jewish culture, Yiddish, all that kind of stuff. But what's he going to do with secular learning? Rav Kook has his own very specific brand of combination, and that's based on Kodesh and Chol. You may not have ever heard anything like this before, but what we're going to do today is we're going to learn about four or five excerpts from Rav Kook. Some of them are in English, just so that we can get through them. Some of them are in Hebrew, so that you can get a feel for Rav Kook's Hebrew. I do not do justice to Rav Kook's Hebrew. You need a real Israeli who knows Rav Kook. You need my son to come in and teach you Rav Kook, because he will teach it much better than me. And there are others that will teach it even better than him. But I'm what you've got, so we'll have to put up with that. Okay, number one. Let's have a look. Kodesh and Chol. Says Rav Kook. And this is taken from all different writings of Rav Kook. This is from Oros HaKodesh. Oros was his big series, produced originally by him and then by his Talmidim, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, the David HaNazir. Some of them are from his letters, we'll see. Some of them are from his notebooks that he scribbled in Russia. We'll see how it works. Number one. Yesh Olam Shel Chol. There is a world of the secular. V'Olam Shel Kodesh. And there's a world of the Kodesh. I don't know how to describe Kodesh. Holy. Okay, let's use the word holy. I'm not getting into a whole different definition of what Kodesh is, but something's a Chol and something's a Kodesh. Yeah, Shabbat is Kodesh and Thursday is Chol. Lechem Avdil ben Kodesh v'Chol. Science is Chol and Chumash is Kodesh. Fine. Olamim shel Chol. In fact, there are whole worlds of secular, the Olamim shel Kodesh. It's multifaceted and worlds of Kodesh. Ha'olamim sotrim zeh et zeh. This is quite easy Hebrew to start with. These worlds contradict each other, because we have to separate from them, right? Hamavdil, bain, this, and this. It's not the same. Kodesh is Kodesh and Chol is Chol. You can't get confused with it. Kumuvan, but it's very clear, he says, Hasira hi subjektivit. The stira is subjective. The clash is subjective only. You think there's a clash. From where you're looking, it looks like there's a clash. But actually, there is no clash. Ha'adam, a person, b'hasagato ha'mitzumtzemet, with their very limited understanding, eino yachol lefasher ben hakodesh uben hachol. They can't in any way make common ground. What's a pshara? Pshara is where I take Maya to court and she says I owe her $100,000 and I say I owe her nothing, and the court says, you know something, let's compromise at what's more of a real middle ground. He says most people with a very limited understanding, they don't know how to make a pshara, how to bond, how to synthesize kodesh and chol. Ve'eino yochol hashvot et stirotehem. They don't know how to even out those clashes. But in fact, these things are reconcilable in the highest possible realm, the Machon Kodesh HaKadoshim, in the realm of the Holy of Holies. Meaning, we're familiar with this idea that there's Chol and there's Kodesh, and there's also Kodesh Kadoshim. Like in the temple, right? So there was the outside areas, then there was the Kodesh, the inside sanctified areas, and then there was the Kodesh Kadoshim, which is the Holy of Holies. So most people will think that it's like a line. There's Chol, then it gets like more Kodesh, and then Kodesh Kadoshim is the most Kodesh. There's no. It's more like a pyramid. It's a triangle, like I've drawn you here. There's Chol and there's Kodesh, and the ultimate resolution of Chol and Kodesh, where they are no longer in conflict with each other, is Kodesh Kadoshim. It's a very different way of looking at the world. And again, if you're not coming from the world of Rav Kook, if you're coming from a traditional Eastern European, Litvish, or, you know, world of the yeshivas, what's going on here? No, it's very clear. There's a line, you know? This is going to make you confused. Says Rav Kook, that's the whole point. You think, once you think things are simple, you know you're not seeing them right.
You've been confused the whole time.
Right. You've been limited the whole time. So he's going to say that on a certain level, if you can reach that, combinations of these things is not just a good balance. You know, let's learn some history and let's learn some Torah and we'll be rounded people. Torah in Derech Eretz. It's actually like an alchemy. Yeah, you're putting two things together and you're making a new thing which is precious. In fact, the truth is that Torah Amada in YU, there are different ways of understanding what Torah Amada means. Rabbi Norman Lamb, who passed away about a year and a half ago now, very important person in YU, he wrote a book called Torah Umada, where he defines what he thinks Torah Umada is, and you should buy the book, it's very interesting, and he thinks ultimately it comes out of almost like Rav Kook. The idea of synthesizing Torah and secular learning in order to make something which is holier between the two of them. Now, the real problem with the YU model is, does it work? Meaning the question with Rav Kook is, does this even work with highly spiritualized people in Israel? Kal v'chomer, the more so, does something like this work living in Manhattan? Or wherever, or in the Heights? Or is it just like naive? People are not going to get this. Yes?
Isn't that like what Chassidish thought is? Like,
good, exactly. It's Chassidish. And in the sense that Rabbi Lam says, if you follow, and Rav Kook's coming out of Chassidut as well, if you follow the line of thinking of Chassidut, that I can connect with God by being a farmer and milking my cow, and my milking of the cow can be Avodas HaKodesh, I don't have to be sitting in Volozhin learning the top-level Tosfos, I can be a connected, so if you can connect with God through learning milking a cow, then all the more so, in theory, you can connect with God by doing a PhD in biomedical engineering.
Yeah, well...
That's the theory.
But the cow doesn't talk you out of church,
oh, right? So that's the practice. Mm-hmm. That's the practice. Sitting on a milking cow and thinking of God, nothing is pushing me away. Mm-hmm. Whereas being in Brandeis for 7 years, doing a PhD on biomedical engineering, there's a lot of stuff which is pushing. That's a good question. Like any hashgraphic discussion, which is not what we're going to have now, because I know everybody wants to talk about hashgrapher all the time. So there are two discussions that you have to have with hashgrapher. What is the right hashgrapher for you, number one? Yeah. And number two, does it actually work? There's no point having a hashgacha which fits you perfectly, but which when plonked into the real world means that you'll just basically, you know, implode. That's not how all your children will. You can't do it. It has to be true, and it has to also work. Fine. Okay, so Rav Kook starts off by saying the combination of secular and chol is the ultimate Kodesh Kadoshim if you know what you're doing. Let's go on a little bit, because there's a lot of ideas we need to put together. Number two. It's very incorrect that there is a war between Chol and Kodesh. It's essential that we have to find a Derech Shalom. We have to find a peaceful path that involves both of these. Shehachol v'hakodesh, because the secular and the holy, afal pi sheheim nirem ke'ilu heim mitnagdim zel azeh t'chaim. This is more of the same kind of thing. Even though it looks as though they're clashing with each other, against each other, each one is going in its own channel, which is specific for it. Through that, by having more clarity on what each is trying to do, and not trying to kind of just crash them against each other, then if you can understand what they really do, not only will they not fight each other, they will actually give strength to each other. I'll give you an example in a minute. Because each of these two powers now, which are in your life, the Kodesh and the Chol, and which are in reality, it will help its friend, its other one, to achieve its underlying goals. Rabbi Sacks speaks this out in an extremely important book called The Great Partnership. The Great Partnership is a must read. And it won't take you long to read. It's quite a thick book, but it's a very easy read. You know, it's a page turner. It's not one of these books that you have to read each paragraph like 100 times, what's he saying. Rabbi Sacks' genius is that he could communicate extremely important, profound ideas in a way that really speaks to people. It's a very unusual talent. So you should read his book, because he talks there about the science versus religion, which is what he's talking about here as well. We see this as a stira, as a clash. And the Christians also set this up as a clash. And you, especially if you're American, but even if you're English, are brought up in a world where you're assuming that whatever science is and whatever religion is, they go against each other. And they set up these debates on the radio or the TV or whatever, where they get some very, you know, urbane, scientific, normal, rational-sounding person, and some crazy, off-the-wall, evangelical nutcase, and they put them against each other, and they conclude that, well, of course, you see, of course, that religion is completely ridiculous, and science is the way, you know. They set that up, yeah? That's why you need to watch the debate between Rabbi Sacks and Richard Dawkins, which is the same kind of issue. You can Google it, Sacks, Dawkins, debate. There's a 25-minute YouTube video, and there's like an hour and 25-minute YouTube video. One is just, you know, different things. And they had this debate about 5, 6, maybe 4, 7, 8 years ago, Rosh Hashanah time. They put Dawkins in a room, Rabbi Sacks in a room, and they really kind of, they're quite combative. It's not one of these just kind of bromance, legs all hold hands. You know, Rabbi Sacks accuses Dawkins of being an anti-Semite. Yeah, and Dawkins accuses Rabbi Sacks of being a religious fundamentalist. And they have but what becomes very clear through the debate is that Rabbi Sacks and Richard Dawkins, almost everything that Richard Dawkins throughout the whole of his, for those who don't know Richard Dawkins, he's a very eminent evolutionary biologist in Cambridge. He's a top scientist in his field. But unlike most scientists who just say, you know, I'm just going to do my science and I'm not interested in debating religion, Dawkins is radically anti-religion. He will hire, you know, posters on buses saying God is a myth and, you know, you're abusing your children if you tell them religious values. He's very radical. But of course, almost everything that Dawkins does not believe in very strongly, Rabbi Sacks says, well, I also don't believe in that. Meaning you've created this religious straw man that you now knock down. But you've just created something that actually maybe the Christian evangelicals believe in, maybe. But we don't believe that. So actually work out what Torah really says before you say you don't believe in it. So Rav Kook is really saying that. He's saying that if you just let science do what science does, and let Torah do what Torah does, then they won't fight each other. On the contrary, they'll actually give strength to each other. And Rabbi Sacks builds this up. He talks a lot about the fact that people don't really understand what Torah is for. They think Torah is about how the world was created. And many more fundamentalist teachers in Torah paint themselves into these corners. Yeah, you know what I mean by painting yourself into a corner? You're painting the floor, and you just paint the floor until eventually you paint yourself into a corner, and then like, where do I go now? You didn't need to do that. They set up, well, the Torah believes that the world is 5,700 years old, and the Torah doesn't believe in evolution, and then you have to defend these. You end up using arguments that are not Jewish, that are Christian arguments, but you don't feel that you can let the side down. So Rabbi Sacks goes very patiently through and shows how you don't have to say that. Science is often not what people think science is. Science doesn't solve questions of meaning in life. It's not trying to solve why you exist or what you should do, or it's just trying to ask, how do things work, which is very important. So once you understand science and Torah, you'll be able to, you see them as a partnership rather than as antagonists, and that's exactly what Rav Cook's saying. Yes, exactly.
What about when they say, the Big Bang Theory?
What about the Big Bang Theory? So again, I think people use very kind of soundbite things like, scientists believe in the Big Bang, and therefore they now agree that God, that like something created that was the beginning of something in the world. I've heard that many times. It's not really what the Big Bang Theory says. The Big Bang Theory doesn't believe that God started the Big Bang. It means that something caused the Big Bang, and something caused the thing that caused the thing, and caused it. Meaning there's infinite cause and effect going back, And Torah really doesn't have anything to say about how the world was created. There's a whole story of Bereshis there, but it's not the reason for it. It's not how the world was created. It's the reason why the world was created, and that's very different. We'll come to that right now. Okay, look at number three. Let's read a bit faster because there's a lot to say. When you go from the world of Kodesh to Chol, how are you going to go to college? Or the other way around, come from college to yeshiva, whatever. If you do it b'loh hadraga, if you do it without gradations, then what will happen to your soul is what will happen to your body, the chushavo, your senses, when they go from one extreme to another. Let's say you walk out of a pitch black room into a brilliant light. That you can't do that. Or from something very hot, something very cold. It would cause you pain, and sometimes damage. You can't do that religiously either. There are two ways to protect against this. To make sure that you don't get burnt by the contrast between the two. Or to organize your exit in a more kind of holy way. Now, either you can go from high to low. You start from a high Kodesh and you gradually let yourself get less Kodesh until you're used to Chol, and it's going from Kodesh to Chol, v'chein hala and onwards, until you get to the Chol. Zoti mida kol adam. That is the way that most people do it. Aval od madriga yoter yonayim sex. But there's a better way to do it, and this is very, very important for Rav Kook. Vehi haramat kol achol kula el kodesh. Rather than trying to go from kodesh to chol, try and get your chol and see the kodesh in the chol and push the chol up to kodesh. Rav Kook had a phrase. He said there isn't really kodesh and chol. There's kodesh and not yet kodesh. Because you should be making your chol into something much more kodesh. Zoti amida amula shebetzidikim. That's the way to do it. V'hamida tzfuyo le'olem ba'atidon nizkav. And that's the way it will one day be done when the world's perfecting itself. V'yom ha'hu yeh al metelot asus kodesh l'ashem, which is the Pasuk in Zechariah, which is where people will write on the bells of the horses, kodesh l'ashem, meaning even the horses will be like the Kohen Gadol, who had a kodesh l'ashem written on his tzitz. There's a Pasuk in Zechariah, meaning the way to do it is not to pull Kodesh down, but to pull Chol up. Now, all of these are beautiful ideas. How do they work in practice? How do they work in terms of your daily life, doing your MA, PhD, whatever? That's a good question. And Rav Kook never really addresses that question. And in fairness, even if he had addressed it in 1904, it wouldn't be that helpful to you in 2021. Sorry, even in 1921, but 2021. So it's actually quite good that Rav Kook doesn't give you practical ways to do this, because they would be irrelevant. Rav Soloveitchik went to university, okay? So did the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Lubavitcher Rebbe was at the Sorbonne. Rav Soloveitchik was in Berlin University. Top academic institutions, but they were there in the 1920s. That's not the same. Oh, so you see, well, Soloveitchik should go to college. Excuse me, Maryland College. The University of Maryland in 2021 is not like the Sorbonne in 1920. It's not. I'm not saying you can't go to Maryland. You can. But I'm just saying you can't use the same preparatory systems to succeed there. So what you're getting from Rav Kook is the idea. This is what you should be trying to do. Let's go on. Let's do a bit of English. Let's talk about science now. And then we'll talk about evolution, which I think let's talk about evolution right now. Let's skip science, and we'll come back, if we have time. Number five. So let's look at a couple of things. Three sources. Let's do two in English. Why don't you read? Does someone else want to read? Oh, big response there. Okay, I'll read the English. Fine. Number five. The doctrine of evolution, says Rav Kook, that is currently conquering the world. So he's writing this at the beginning of the 20th century. This is in his Shmonek Vatim. His Shmonek Vatim were written while he's still in Boisk. yeah, or just after he came to Israel. So it's early 20th century. When did Darwin live? When did Darwin publish The Origin of Species? I can't remember. Something in the region of the 1850s, 60s, something in that memory. By the early 1900s already, Darwinism and evolutionary theory is beginning to take the world by storm. That everything started very basic and worked its way up until you are the pinnacle of evolution. Until you have children. And then you're basically just a monkey compared to them. And they are the next pinnacle of evolution.
Amen.
Okay, fine. Good. So the question is, does Judaism accept evolution? And you've probably been told many times, no, it doesn't. Isn't it contrary to everything we think? You know, Adam Arish was on the highest level and everything's downhill from there. The people at Sinai were on the top level and everything's downhill from there. You read us Hadorot. We're all smaller in each generation. Okay, so he's going to say like this. The doctrine of evolution that's currently conquering the world jives, I don't like the word jives really, I can't remember who translated this, it sounds more like sort of some 1950s people dancing, okay, with the eternal secrets of Kabbalah to a larger degree than any other philosophical doctrine, okay, the Hebrew word is he mit amet, okay, mit amet, like it's mat'im, it connects together with the eternal secrets of Kabbalah to a larger degree than any other philosophical doctrine. It's very close to Kabbalah. Because if you know Kabbalah, you won't be at all surprised by evolution. In fact, you will realize that this is exactly what Kabbalah has been trying to tell people for the last 500, 800 years. Evolution that goes in an ascending route gives the optimistic foundation to the world. Think of how optimistic evolution is. Everything's getting better and better. As opposed to Eurydice Hadorus, which is everything's going downhill. Because how is it possible to despair? When we see everything develop and ascend, when we pierce to the inside of the doctrine of ascending development, we find in it the divine matter shining with complete clearness, clarity, I think it should be in English. Evolution shines light on all of Hashem's ways in the world. Creation as a whole develops and ascends, just as this matter is noticeable in parts of it, the ascent is general as well as particular. It rises to the peak of the absolute good. Rav Kook's, this is fundamental. Rav Kook's worldview is a Kabbalistic worldview, is that everything ultimately is going upwards. Okay? Everything is heading up. As opposed to the classic system Jewish worldview, which is that everything is going down. And of course this, as we've spoken about in past classes, this connects with their worldviews on Mashiach. The classic view that you've probably been taught of the Mashiach is everything's going to get so bad, so bad, so bad, so bad, so bad, then Mashiach is going to have to come and pull everything up so that it can reach the ways of Mashiach. That's why people talk all about, oh, next week if Mashiach has come, Mashiach is going to come, Mashiach will have come. According to Rav Kook, that's not how Mashiach works. And by the way, according to the Rambam, the same, also like Rav Kook. That the world is gradually going further and further and further higher until in a gradual process it reaches the level of Mashiach. So Mashiach does not need to be miraculous. You don't need, this has to be a miracle. If you're at the rock bottom, 49, you know, those are about the top 49th level. 49 just means like the height, the worst you, or the height you can get. Yeah? It's a symbolic number. It's just 7 squared. 7 is like the most, it represents this world on steroids. It's like 70 as well. 70, Shivim, Pan in the Torah, etc. Now, so if everything is at the bottom, then you need a miracle to stretch it up. But if everything's going up, then you don't. Which is why Rav Kook can have an unfolding process of Geula, that you can see that things are actually the redemption happening, even though it's not miraculous. The war against Hamas in Gaza is part of the redemptive process. Now if you believe in this, then you think that's nonsense. Because the war is just another way that everything's getting worse. Whereas if you believe in this, then you see the war as another way of another step up. Leah.
For these two completely opposite ideas.
Says Rav Kook, you have to understand Kabbalah. And the truth is, you don't have to understand Kabbalah only, because the Rambam talks about this as well. He brings, there are sources, classic sources for both of these views. In Tanakh, in the Talmud, etc. You can create views for both of these. I'll give you an example. In terms of Torah learning, in the classic view, we have a principle of Lo B'Shamayim Hi, right?
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that God revealed the Torah to Moshe, there is no more divine revelation. Yeah, the Rambam says prophecy is no good in order to give you more Torah. If a prophet through prophecy gives you Torah, that disqualifies them as a prophet. because there's one revelation, and it all goes down like this from that. Okay? Whereas Kabbalah actually says the opposite, which is that as each Kabbalist goes through the generations, the revelation increases. So, the Arizal was able to learn with Eliyahu HaNavi, and the Baal Shem Tov was able to learn with Achiah HaShiloni, or, I can't remember if I got this exactly right, but they're telling them new things, new ideas. God is coming to these people in revelation, Kabbalistically, and teaching them new developing ideas. Now, if you say that in the world of classic halacha, you'll get thrown into the local asylum. God comes to me and tells me what we should do on Shabbos. That's not how halacha works, but that is how Kabbalah works. And each generation was like tohu vavohu compared to the next. Confusion and to the next. Yeah? So the Rav Kook says the only reason that we feel this is like against the grain is because we're not sufficiently Kabbalistically aware. So we haven't got to Mashiach ben Yosef yet. He's going to talk about Mashiach ben Yosef. But Mashiach ben Yosef is another way of seeing how the Geula can come through a physical rather than a miraculous means. Yes, we're going to get there when we get there. Okay, fine. Let's look at number six. Yes. Okay, so in present day, in the world around us, the Haredi world very much follows the Yuridus Hadoras view. And the religious Zionist world, coming out of Rav Kook, very much follows the ascending view. They are the two most obvious. The modern Orthodox world, I don't think, has a very clear position on this. It focuses on other things. And it does have a position, but it's not the main focus. I'll give you an example. Let me give you an example. By the way, there is a melding going on to some degree of religious Zionism and modern Orthodoxy, certainly in North America, where more and more Israel ideas are coming back to North America. As the yeshivas, as most people's children in the religious community go to yeshiva, and then or seminary, and then come back to Israel, to America, that's bringing a lot of the hashkafic ideas of Israel back to America. Which means that in the Haredi community, it's importing the Kollel Lakewood type mentality, which didn't exist to the same degree in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, but because it did in Israel, the guys come back from Israel and come back and say, Yoli, you have to learn all the time. Their fathers, who were very frum, are working and learning. But they can't do that because they bring the Israeli model back. And the modern Orthodox kids who are coming to Israel are almost always going to religious Zionist seminaries and yeshivas, because there aren't really any modern Orthodox seminaries and yeshivas in the same sense. So they're bringing those ideas back. And then people are putting blue into their tzitzis, cheles and all that. Yeah? Because these are... So I'll give you an example. Let's take cheles as an example. The idea of tcheles, of putting the blue in the tzitzit, why do we put blue now that we never did before? So of course in the Chumash we do have to have blue. It says there has to be a psil tchelet. And the Gemara talks about this as well. But after the Gemara we lost the tradition as to what the tcheles would be, and we stopped doing it because we don't want to just put something which is wrong on, so we just went with pure white. Over the last 50-100 years there's been an awful lot of work done to try and re-identify the tcheles. There's a lot to say about this which is not ready for now. But certainly in the religious Zionist world, there's a very strong feel that this what we rediscovered clearly is Cheles, archaeologically and based on the chemistry of it. There's a wonderful line. Rabbi Hertz, you may have heard of Rabbi Hertz, Joseph Hertz. He was the chief rabbi of the British Empire between, let's say, 1912 and 1948, something like that. As a young man... I've got this wrong, sorry. It wasn't Rabbi Hertz, scrub that. It was Rabbi Herzog, Rabbi Isaac Herzog, who was the first chief rabbi of Israel, whose grandson has just been appointed the president of Israel. Yeah, Buzi Herzog is the grandson of Isaac, the first chief rabbi of the state of Israel, Isaac Herzog, fine. So he's named after him, Yitzhak Herzog, whatever. So Rabbi Herzog, when he was a young man, did a PhD in chemistry in Ireland. Yeah, so his PhD thesis was the tcheles, identifying what the actual sea creature is that you squeeze and make the tcheles. So he has an entire PhD thesis, which he did in Dublin. The whole story as to how when he lived in Dublin, he was very close to Éamon de Valera, who was the first of the Irish prime ministers, whatever, not for now. He hid in his house, not for now. So he did this whole PhD thesis, and he said, I'm absolutely 1,000% convinced The Tchelet comes from the Murex trunculus, which is a little snail. I'm 1,000% convinced. I've only got one problem. The Gemara is very clear as to what the color should be, and when you make it, it's the wrong color. So apart from the fact that the color comes out wrong, everything else works. But what, of course, he was doing wrong, that he didn't know at the time, is he was doing the experiments under artificial light in Ireland. When you do the same thing under ultraviolet in the sun in Israel, it comes out the correct color, because the UV affects the color of the pigmentation and it makes it right. So there's a very strong rediscovery in Tchelet. So why is the Haredi world not wear Tchelet? I mean, what can go wrong? What can you do wrong? Well, how bad can it be? Even if you get it wrong. I mean, Rav Herschel Schefter, by the way, Rav Herschel Schefter, who is from YU. Good. So let's say Rav Herschel Schefter from YU, he actually thinks halakhically that it's a problem if you don't wear the Tchelet. He's not coming from a religious Zionist perspective, but he says, if it is the right Tchelet, and you choose not to wear it, then you're actually committing the Torah prohibition of Loisigra, of taking away from the mitzvah. If it's the wrong Tchelet, you didn't lose anything, because the Lavan doesn't have to be Lavan. It can be yellow, it can be pink, it can be green. So it's the wrong blue, Seder. Anyway, so why don't the Haredi world wear Tchelet? So you could argue that it's like economic. People have got enough trouble putting food on the table than having to pay, you know, $50 for each pair of tzitzis, whatever. Fine, you could argue that, which has been argued. But Rav Moshe Sternbuch has a tshuva. Moshe Sternbuch was the head of the Eidah Haredis. He lives in Har Nof. And he said, we have a tradition that Tchelet will only be rediscovered when the world is elevated towards Mashiach. He said, look around you. Things have never been worse in the whole of Jewish history. So how can you argue this could be Tchelet when you can see things have never been worse? So the exact same country in which these two people, if you like, live. One's looking around saying things have never been worse, and one's looking around saying things have never been better. That's this. In a nutshell. So that's, if you're asking who does what, the answer is that's who does what. Okay, that was a bit of a too long what's the discourse on that? Number six, English, then we'll do a Hebrew one. Regarding the number of years since creation in regard to the calculation of modern geologists. Oh, how old is the universe? It has long been an accepted concept noted by all of the early Kabbalists that there were many eras that preceded our own. As the Midrash states, he created worlds and destroyed them, and the Zohar writes that there were types of men different from Adam, who is described in the Torah. Meaning, was Adam the first man? No. Adam was the first human being with a neshama. But there were lots of kind of proto-humans, Neanderthals, Neanderthals, whatever you want to call them, who were wandering around at the time. He says that's a long-held Kabbalistic concept. But one must contemplate well the deep allegories which demand extensive explanation over the page. Modern research tells us that the eras of creation, including man, have been discovered. But there was no mass destruction between these eras. Meaning, okay, you could turn around and say the Kabbalistic model doesn't work. Because the Kabbalistic model is there were eras and then destruction, and then eras and then destruction. But that's not what people were saying in evolution at the time of Rav Kook. Darwin was arguing for a graduated, you know, the truth is that neo-Darwinism is more open to the idea of a punctuated equilibrium, that sort of mass disaster, you know, if things happen, that push things into a new era. So maybe, and I'm not a scientist, so I'm not going to tell you about science because I get it wrong. But he says, okay, so fine, modern research says it's not like the Kabbalah, but these are assumptions that are up in the air with no conclusive proof, and one need not be concerned with them. And that's an important point. Just like you can't misunderstand Torah and think it's just something that it's not meant to do, don't misunderstand science. Science predicts things which are repeatable, predictable phenomena. Okay? It doesn't necessarily have to be right, and it very often isn't right when it's making big theoretical suppositions like the existence of the multiverse. You know what the multiverse is? The multiverse is a very important idea in science, which is not a new idea, but there's a big problem in science, which is why is everything in the universe just perfectly calibrated? It's extremely unlikely. And this is not coming from like a Kirov discovery seminar type place. This is written by the, you know, top, you know, cosmologists, scientists, etc. Everything, not just the obvious things like the, you know, distance of the Earth from the Sun, and if it was any closer it would all frazzle up, and if it was any further away it would all freeze over. Or the existence of a super planet like Jupiter just at the right distance from us, so that any major comets are drawn by gravity into Jupiter rather than facing us. I mean, these things are all set up that way. But also the ratio between, you know, the nuclear force and magnetic force, and all of the, if they were just a fraction to many decimal places out, then nothing would exist. My wife bought me a book many years ago called Just Six Numbers, written by Sir Martin Rees, who is a very prominent astronomer, cosmologist in London. And he used to be what's called the Astronomer Royal, which is the official astronomer for England, you know. He wrote this book called Just Six Numbers, where he goes through these six amazing coincidences that the universe is just perfectly and very improbably calibrated for life to exist. And then in the last chapter he says, how do you explain this? And he says, quite honestly, he says, of course if I was a religious, I would say that God made it. It's a design which gives rise to the assumption of a designer. He says, but I'm not religious, so I can't say God, and God is not a scientific answer, which is true. You can't answer a scientific question by God did it. That doesn't mean you're anti-religious, it just means you're trying to be a scientist. So because God is not a scientific phenomenon. Good. You can ask an answer on a theological level. You can say, I'm a theologist and I think that God did it, but you can't answer that as a scientist. Scientist has to be something which is predictable and repeatable and within the physical world. God is by definition beyond the physical world, and science is not able to go there. Okay? So he says, so what's the answer? The answer is the multiverse. What's the multiverse? You have to say that there are an infinite number of universes, all of which exist. We happen to be in the one which works. Meaning in an infinite system, even if it's highly, highly, highly improbable that it could be calibrated, then on an infinite basis it has to be that one of them will. At least one of them will. So I suppose it could be that there are other universes within the infinite system that also did. Actually, it's interesting. Why wouldn't there have to be infinite numbers that also did? Okay, I don't know. I'm not enough of a mathematician to work that out. But the point is that the multiverse is something which may or may not be true, but it's very difficult to prove scientifically. It's not impossible. It's almost like a faith. It's almost like a religious belief. So Rav Kook just says, just... Okay, good. So Rav Kook just says that don't get so excited that everything that science says is true. He's not trying to diss science at all. He's just trying to say that science says some things which are clearly correct. The Earth is not flat. By the way, nobody sensible thought the Earth was flat.
Even back
in the ancient world, they knew the Earth was round. Because they surely did, absolutely. Excuse me, there are midrashim that talk about Alexander the Great going up in the sky and seeing the curvature of the Earth. Everybody has to know the Earth is round. Why? Because the ship sails to the horizon and disappears. Where did it go? they sail back again and they say, we didn't go anywhere. We just kept on going forward. So why couldn't I see you? Obviously, you've gone down under the horizon. Thank God. It was scared, stupid sailors that said we're going to fall off the end of the world. But they did think that the universe was geocentric. They did think the Earth was the center of the solar system. Okay, so now we know that the Earth is not. So I don't think there's any point in trying to prove that the Earth is flat or that the Earth is the center of the solar system. But other things that science says may be completely speculative. Carry on. But in truth, page 3, we do not need all of this. For even if it was conclusively proven that creation took place through development of species, there would be no contradiction with the Torah. Even if everything that evolution says is true. But we count according to the simple explanation of the words of the Torah, which is more relevant to us than other sources, which are of little value for us. Meaning, we count our years on a pshat level, which is very straightforward. And the Torah certainly concealed the story of creation and spoke in hints and allegories. All know that creation is one of the secrets of the Torah. It's called in the Gemara, Ma'aseh Bereshit. It goes with Ma'aseh Merkava. Ma'aseh Merkava is the deeds of the chariot. It's Yechezkel's vision of the chariot and the highest level of Kabbalistic ideas. It's very esoteric. So too Ma'aseh Bereshit. Ma'aseh Bereshit, they say Chazal, is one of the most hidden things to understand what's going on. Rabbi Katz once put it to me this way. He said to me that if you pick up a posik in Bamidbar, what you read on the posik is pshat, the superficial level. If you want to get to sod, to the deep Kabbalistic level, you've got to dig. When you read the story of creation, he said, it's inverted. You're reading sod. You're not reading pshat. You're reading something which is highly, highly allegoristic. Allegorical? One of those two. If you want to get to pshat, you have to dig as deep as you would in other places to get to mysticism. So whatever you're reading when you're reading Bereshit, it's not what it looks like. It's not about a man and a woman and a talking snake like we said yesterday. It's not about day 1, day 2, day 3, day 4, day 5. Who said there are even days? It's not about anything you think it's about. All we know is that the creation is one of the secrets of Torah. If we were to understand the matter according to the literal meaning, what secret would that be? If it's so straightforward, why is it considered one of the deepest Kabbalistic mysteries of the world? Even evangelical Christians in Texas know what it means, right? They open it in English and it says, God created. Okay? In the beginning. So, okay, simple now. If you think it's simple, obviously you're completely mistaken. The Midrash already states, to recount the power of creation to flesh and blood is impossible. The Torah therefore concealed the matter with the words, in the beginning God created. The main point is the conclusion that emerges from the discussion to know that God and to know God and true moral life. And that's what Rabbi Sacks said in the Great Partnership. The story of creation is not about how the world was made, it's about why the world was made. And Rashi says this, the very first Rashi's. Bereshit. Rashi says, that doesn't mean in the beginning. If you wanted to say in the beginning, you would have had to say Bereshona. You may have learned this. Bereshit means that he brings a drash for the sake of Reshit. What is Reshit? In the other psukim, that Reshit is a reference to the Jewish people, a reference to the Torah, etc. That the world was created for the sake of. In other words, the question that the Torah is posing to you is not how was the world made, but why? Why was the world made? Why is there life? Why do you exist? That's not a scientific question at all. That's what the Torah is asking. Okay? Have a look here in number 7. Is the story of the Garden of Eden a literal story or not? Number 7. This is a letter that he wrote, so the Hebrew is a bit easier. I feel I need to explain to you the more refined, the more spiritual way forward. And I want to try and explain how to understand modern scientific analysis of this, of cosmology, etc. Because most of these scientists are against the Torah, straightforward view that you get from the Torah. My opinion on this is as follows. Anyone with a clear, straight mind, he has surely to know the following. Even though these new sciences don't reveal the perfect, complete truth, don't get into scientism. Rabbi Kalinsky has a lot to say about this. Scientism is where you turn science into a religion. And just because science says it, you believe that it has to be the way that is forward. You believe in science. So even though we can't make that mistake, third line, we call Mark on, we don't have to feel we have to oppose everything that science says. Because the way of the Torah is certainly not to just tell us simple facts of Ma'asim Shaya and what happened. Just one second, Sita, I need to go through this. The Torah's purpose is not to tell us what happened. It may tell us what happened. There was a man called Abraham and he had a son called Isaac and they went and did an Akedah. But fine, good. But that's not the purpose of the Torah. That's not why you're reading it. This is a very, very important point, which maybe I'll bring out for a minute now. How can there be a machlokas about how old Yitzchak was at the Akedah? How can there be a machlokas? It's a historical fact. You read Rashi, he was 37. You read Ibn Ezra, he was like 11 or 12. So they can't both be right. He can't have been 37 and 11. One of them is right, one of them is wrong. Both of them could be wrong, like logically, but they can't both be right. So how do you understand that? What are they disagreeing on? Is one of them just wrong? No, because they're not trying to work out how old was Yitzchak at the time of the Akedah. That's an interesting historical fact, which is actually irrelevant. What they're trying to work out is, what is the purpose of this text? What is this text trying to communicate to you? When you read these words that God gave to Moshe, what does he want you to get out of them? Does he want you to read them as the story of a man aged 37 who was, thrust up on an altar to be executed, to be slaughtered? Or does he want you to read the story of a boy who was 11? It's a completely different story, depending on which way you read it. So the machlokas is not about how old Yitzchak was. The machlokas is about how are you meant to read these words. Now that doesn't mean, don't get me wrong, don't say, we say he never happened. I'm not saying that at all. With Bereshit, yeah, you could, Adam and Chava and the snake, if you think it's just like a video play of, that's probably ridiculous. But with Adam and Yitzchak and Avram and Yitzchak and Yaakov, etc., yeah, these people existed, they had lives, there was Mitzrayim, they went there, they came out. It's not ahistorical. But it's not, the purpose of the text is not to be historical, any more than the purpose of Bereshit is to be cosmological. or the purpose of the story of Leah and the Judaim is to be pharmacological and teach you what to take if you're having trouble getting pregnant. That's not the purpose. You may be able to pick up some good hints, but that's not the purpose. You get that? That's a very important point. Because people get very kind of nervous when you say these things. And you say, oh, are you telling me the Torah never happened? No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm telling you that the purpose of the Torah is not to tell you what happened. That's what Rav Cook has said. Is that clear? It's a very important point. Okay? Let's just carry on a little bit. Ha'ika hu ha'toch. Fourth line, three words in. The main purpose of the Torah is the toch, is the central message that you're meant to get out of it. Has barah pnimit, the inner explanation by inyanim, which are in these issues. Ze yitromam od yoter b'chol makom shenim sakoach soter. And every time you see contradiction, you know you're on to something good. It's like everything the opposite of what you'd have thought. You shouldn't start kind of waking up in a hot sweat at night because science contradicts Torah. If there's a contradiction, then you know you're about to get deeper into something. I gotta read that line again. The Zayitromem Od, it gets higher, more and more elevated. Od Yoter B'chol Makom, whenever Shenimta Koach Soter, whenever you feel something pushing against it. She'anu Mit'oidim Lehit Gaber Al Yado. Because when we hit upon a major problem in Jewish thought, this encourages us to think more deeply to overcome it. Ikram Shel Dvarim Nemru Kfar B'Divrei Arishonim B'Rishom HaMorin Nebuchim. And he says, don't take this from me. Read the Morin Nebuchim. Read the Rambam. And now we're in an amazing position to go further and further on this, to get deeper. The Rav Cook, when he dealt with heresy, people who were writing, let's say, biblical criticism, which says that the Torah was not written by Moshe or whatever, how are you meant to respond to things which are bang against the Torah? So most people in the world would say, don't read them, because you're not meant to read heresy. And I'm not sure Rav Cook would disagree with that. No, not everybody should be running out there to read books of heresy to try and, you know, get a deeper basis. But if you're presented with them, heresy is an opportunity to think more deeply about your religious beliefs. You may have had a very superficial understanding of Judaism, which is why you have a problem with this person's argument. So the problem may not be their argument. The problem may be your superficiality that you thought X and it's not true. So this is now an opportunity for you to deepen your thought. He said, that's why all the kids in his generation are going off the derech. He says, they're not going off the derech because they are going against Judaism. They're going off the derech because they're too sophisticated for the Judaism that you're teaching them. He says that many times. You've got to get more sophisticated because they're getting sophistication elsewhere. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, by the way, in a different vein, said that however educated you are in Chol, you may not be less educated in Kodesh. That's why he was very strong on the idea of women learning Gemara. Because if you're taking women who are learning on a very complex philosophical intellectual level, the Rebbe's already very strong on women learning Gemara. He says because if you're learning Gemara, if you're learning doing an MA or a PhD in a university and you're thinking in a complex level, and yet in Judaism someone's teaching you something very simple, then you're bound to turn around and say Judaism is simplistic and academia is sophisticated. So however sophisticated you are in academia, you have to be at least as sophisticated in Limud HaKodesh, which is an interesting perspective. And Rav Cook also, I don't know what he felt about women learning Gemara, I haven't read into that, but certainly on this issue, I'm sure that he wants people to think more clearly. Second paragraph. Eilanu shum nafke mina. Now he's going to say something that sounds actually quite controversial. We don't actually care one hoot. There is no practical difference to us. If the world originally started with a golden age, the Garden of Eden, yeah? Where man had the pleasure in this paradise of spiritual and physical abundance. We don't care if that was the beginning. Or... or we all started from being amoebas, amoebae, whatever it is. I don't care whether the world started as the Garden of Eden or whether it started with a single-celled organism. No difference to me. And he went from the very lowest to the very highest. And he still does that. I don't care why. And it's written right like that, because what we need to know from reading Chumash is Sheyesh Asher Gemara, because that there is a very, very real possibility, Sheha Adam, that you as a person, Afilo im yitale b'ma'ala gedola. Even if you're the strongest and the highest, v'yeh muchan l'chol kavod v'oneg, and you're prepared for all honor and pleasure, you're right there at the top. Im yashchit drachav, if you mess up your life, yachol la'abed kol ashelo, you can lose everything that you have. V'yachol la'hara la'atman, you can do terrible evil to yourself, or l'tol datav, and to your children, al dorot rabim ma'ot, for generations to come. That's the message of the Garden of Eden. That no matter how big a holy shmoly you think you are, you can mess it all up for yourself, for your children, for your grandchildren, for generations to come, if you don't choose the right thing. That's a very important message. That's what we're learning from the Garden of Eden. Of him being there and sinning and being thrown out, etc. And when we come to this understanding, Ein anu niskaking od l'chom davke neged siur hamid parnes, hamid parsein, excuse me, ben achokrim lachadashim. We don't need to start arguing with evolutionists. Because we'll say, okay, fine, you know, you want to learn science, you learn science. I'm learning from the Torah something much more important than how the species develops. Something more relevant to my life. I mean, how important really is it on a day-to-day basis as to how mankind was, like, evolved? Really. It's not. It doesn't really impact on your life on a day-to-day basis at all. But the fact that you could mess your life up by making a bad decision is something which probably more useful people should take to heart. Okay, fine. Let's leave that there. But you see where he's coming from. You see why he was controversial?
Mm-hmm.
In a good way. Okay? That's because I'm painting it in a good way. But maybe if I were giving an anti-Rav Kook shiur, maybe I would paint it in a bad way. Because there is a danger as well. You know, people are going to say, oh, Rav Kook tells me I have to do this, I have to do that, and then you end up just confused and...
But he just said you have to be strong in Torah before you do anything.
Correct. There's no question about that at all. Let's just read one more thing on page 6 in English. This whole thing on page 4 and 5 is in English. You can read it yourself. It's basically Rav Kook's analysis as to why everything's gone nuts in the 20th century. He basically says it's because of social change, scientific change, and evolution. He's very big on the idea of evolution making a big change, and he tells people how to deal with all of these things as well. By the way, as I said yesterday, don't think that Rav Kook was a big social revolutionary. When it comes to halakha, on a daily basis, Rav Kook was quite on the machmir side. He was really quite strict. Sometimes people make, same with Rav Soloveitchik, people make these false associations, they think because the guy had a broad mind in terms of hashkofa, he must have been really liberal in halakha. No, not at all. Rav Soloveitchik was a machmir in halakha because of his brisker derech, which led him towards chumrah. And Rav Kook was also a machmir. People don't realize in Shemitah, for example, Rav Kook supports the heta mechira. We talked about that a little bit yesterday. Why? Because in most areas of Shemitah, he's extremely strict. And therefore, the only way that you can even do anything, really, given all of those chumras, is to do the heta mechira. Whereas the Chazon Ish, who is from the Haredi world, he says, we don't need the Chet Mechira, because I can be leaning on that, I can be leaning on that, I can be leaning on this, I can be leaning on this. The Chazon Ish is the one giving all the colors, all the leniences. So he says, why do you need the Chet Mechira? Rav Kook needs the Chet Mechira, because he has no way of circumventing the strict approach to halacha that he takes on the left. So don't fall into false kind of associations. Have a look in page number 60. Last source. It is natural that the contemplation of God comes from the monotheistic opinion, which is more commonplace outlook from the perspective of faith, at times causes sadness and weakness of spirit. Monotheism lets you down. Meaning, it's so much easier to be a pagan, a polytheist. Because then everything makes sense. Oh, why do all these bad things happen to all these good people? Because the gods are all fighting, and there's the bad gods, and the good gods, and the wind gods, and the rain gods, and we're all being kind of thrown around by all these things, and they're not all powerful, and they can't really... Once you have gods that are not all-powerful fighting against each other, then of course life is just a big mess. That's what you'd expect. But if you're a monotheist, therefore you'll be happy. You won't have a crisis of faith. But if you're a monotheist, and you say there's only one overriding God, and God is good, then you're thrown into all sorts of crises like, well, how does that happen? How can this be, etc.? So people who are monotheistic sometimes feel a bit weak and morose, because of the weakness that comes in the spirit of man when he pictures himself as a limited, powerless effect, far from the divine perfection that shines with the splendorous light of its strength. Particularly the weakness is aroused through emphasizing that moral weaknesses are apparent through comparison with God's next perfection in the realm of righteousness and morality. Judaism can leave you very kind of like, well, what's the point, you know? I'm just such a nobody. There's nothing I can do. I'll never be. Less draining than this outlook is the monotheistic outlook that leans towards a Spinozan explanation. Now, whoa, are you telling me that I should pick myself up by Spinoza? Who was Spinoza? In 1 minute. Benedict Spinoza was the first big secular Jew in history. In the 1600s, he basically said, I don't want to be religious, I don't want to be Christian, you know, I just want to be a human being. He's therefore, in the sense, the first secular Jew. He was Jewish born. And he believed in, basically, pantheism. He may have been also atheistic as well as pantheistic, it's not so clear, but let's assume he was pantheistic. He believed that everything is God. Everything is God. Therefore, God is everything you can see in nature. That's what God is. Now, that's a heretical belief. Says Rav Kook, we don't believe that, but if you move a little bit towards that, you'll get the Hasidus. When it's purified from its dregs, meaning Spinoza, if you just purify Spinoza, many aspects of it are apparent in the consensual past of new Hasidus, that there is nothing other than God. And while this perspective should weaken the spirit of a person more than the first outlook, it is not so. Rather, this latter outlook immediately returns to a person the strength of his eternity, and it just encourages him not to forget the truth of his existence, and that it is in his obligation to distance himself from all the ways of life that flow from the mistaken thought of an independent self that is torn in its spirituality from the divine infinity. It's a bit hard to read this in 1 minute. But basically what he says is as follows. We don't believe in pantheism, that everything is God. But we do believe that everything, that God is everything. What do I mean? It's called panentheism. 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 Which means as follows, as opposed to pantheism. Pantheism means that God is the sum total of everything you see in nature around you. Whereas panentheism means that everything in the whole universe, way beyond what you see, but including what you see, is all part of God. Really, everything is God. All of this is virtual. You're living in the matrix. You just don't realize it. You need to be woken up from your slumber to see that really everything is God. You've heard the Hasidic ideas of the sparks of Kedusha, just to go and collect the spark. That's because this looks like a table, but it's not really a table. It's like got these green numbers going up and down, like on the movie, you know? It's got this like spiritual reality. And he says, if Spinoza could have just hung on for 100 years more and been born 100 years later, he could have been a chassid. He could have been a rebbe. But instead he was a heretic. For all sorts of other reasons as well. He was brought up in a very Catholic environment. It was conversos that they thought very... Anyway, whatever. So the point here is that actually you don't need to become depressed by the idea that God is everything, because you realize then that everything is God, in the sense that you're part of God, and you can connect. And you can go and read on your own as to how monotheism can be happy and exciting, not sort of defeatist and sad. He goes through that a lot. These are very important ideas. And they're not ideas that everybody really grapples with in the same way. So just today, in an hour and a bit, we've seen a little bit as to how Kaddish and Chol are seen in the world of Rav Kook. Tomorrow, what I want to look at is, what did I want to do tomorrow? The world of Zionism, I think, and understanding the Klal Yisrael and Zionism and how that works. Okay? Let's leave it there. Thank you very much.